coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Our enemies act without conscience. We must not.
What happens when a democracy stoops to using torture as an instrument of war?
Torture's failure to serve its intended purpose isn't the main reason to oppose its use. It's about who we were, who we are, and who we aspire to be.
Does torture even have a place in a democracy?
Oh, I'm not talking about the actual country. I'm talking about the idea of America. The idea of America would never torture.
Isn't torture for tyrants and terrorists?
When someone or some group is trying to destroy you and your way of life, you need to do whatever it takes to stop them.
What's wrong with a little torture between sworn enemies?
Yeah, Washington tortured the British so hard, they're still talking funny.
Our guest is Darius Rejali, author of Torture and Democracy.
When democracies torture.
This government does not torture people.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford University. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I taught philosophy for 40 years.
And today, we're thinking about what happens when democracies torture.
Well, Ken, philosophical discussions about torture tend to focus on two things. First, is torture, any particular case of torture, ever morally justified? And if so, if you can find such a case, should these exceptions somehow be reflected in the law?
Yeah, John, you know, yeah, philosophers like to focus on extreme cases, torture the terrorist or let the bomb go off and injure hundreds, maybe thousands of innocents.
Sam Harris, in his essay In Defense of Torture, called these ticking bomb cases. So imagine the bomber sitting in your custody, gloating about the imminent explosion and magnitude of human suffering it will cause. Harris thinks that by subjecting this unpleasant fellow to torture, that may just be justifiable if it can prevent the bomb going off.
Yeah, yeah, there's lots of writing about this. Lots of people talk about it. We talked about it with Alan Dershowitz a while ago. Remember that? He argued that there are justifiable cases of torture. He even suggested that the law should encode these extreme circumstances. But, you know, I got to tell you, to my mind, the whole discussion along this line really misses a more important and more pressing issue.
All right. And that would be?
Well, just think about how this whole ticking time bomb thing goes. It presupposes already that torture is basically an unjustifiable evil to be avoided at all cost. And then it's the interesting philosophical question supposed to be whether we can find exceptional circumstances in which maybe it's morally okay.
So you're saying that presupposition, the evil of torture, that isn't widely accepted?
Well, it depends on what you mean by widely accepted. If you judge widely accepted by what people do and take that to be a guide to what they believe, well, then no, torture is not forbidden. It's widespread. It's an everyday practice, in fact.
Well, you mean in tyrannies, in Nazi Germany, or maybe in even present-day Russia, or maybe Syria, places like that.
Oh, John, that's kind of wishful thinking. That's not what I mean. I mean in democracies. I mean right here in the good old U.S. of A, or Japan, or India, or France, or Israel. And I'm not just talking about the distant past. I'm talking about now, today. I'm not just talking in distant, faraway places like Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo. I'm talking about prisons, police stations, places throughout this land, particularly in neighborhoods where high-priced lawyers are, you know, not likely to show their fannies.
Well, surely torture is more common in tyrannies than in democracies, isn't it?
You know, you might think that, but I don't think there's any evidence to support that at all. What is true is that democracies favor types of torture that are easier to hide and harder to prove. They try and do it more in secret. They don't want to leave any bad marks.
Well, I suppose we're better at coming up with euphemisms, too, like enhanced interrogation techniques.
Now you're getting what I'm talking about, John. That's exactly right.
Well, that's pretty awful, Ken. Let's assume your facts are right. So where does philosophy come in? are you going to defend the use of torture by democracies, and then I get to say what's wrong with it?
No such luck, John. I'm not going to give you that kind of false hope that you might actually finally win an argument with me. That's not going to happen. I think what we need to do is to try to articulate why democracies, especially liberal democracies, ought not to torture. And when I'm talking about liberal democracy, I'm not talking about liberal as opposed to conservative. I mean a system that's largely democratic and also is based on people having basic rights and basic dignity.
Yeah, but isn't that just going to lead us right back to the ticking bomb case, the kind of case where we got an argument in favor of torture, even for a, you know, consciously democratic liberal democracy?
It might lead us back there eventually, but we're not going to start there with that automatic presupposition. We're going to start someplace else.
So where should we start?
Well, I think we need to start at the other end. Let's think about it. What is torture? It's one among all kinds of coercive inducements that the state has. I mean, people are offered plea bargains. We let them stew in jail, hoping to break them down, break their will. We offer would-be informants monetary inducements. We do all kinds of things to coercively induce people.
Yeah. But torture, intrinsically, it's so much worse.
Yeah, okay. That's an intuition. But we're philosophers. We want to get beneath that intuition. We want to understand what it is that makes torture worse than any other coercive inducements. And only then, only when we understand that, we'll be in a position to consider, like, the legitimacy of torture in the ticking time bomb case or stuff like that. That's what I think.
Okay, Ken. You're pretty persuasive. So where are we going to start?
Well, I think one place we should start is not with the odds, but let's start with the facts. We know that the U.S. has tortured prisoners of war. And so we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, out to find out what torture looks like in the land of the free and the home of the brave. She files this report.
In November 2001, a man was seized from his parents' house in Mauritania, a country in North Africa. He was sent to a prison in Jordan for 8 months and then shipped off to the Guantanamo Bay detention camp. His name is Mohamedou Ould Slahi. He's never been charged with a crime, and he's still in Guantanamo today. Mohamedou was born to a very poor family, but he was a very smart kid. Excellent grades, spoke 5 different languages, and won a scholarship to study electrical engineering in Germany. Then in the early 1990s, Mohamedou joined Al-Qaeda.
Like many young men, he had gone to Afghanistan as a student to join the fight against the communist government of Afghanistan.
That's Larry Seams. He's the editor of Guantanamo Dreams, a memoir about Mohamedou's life in prison.
But as he's said repeatedly, he broke all ties after the communist government collapsed and the various Mujahideen factions started shooting each other. Mohamedou essentially said, I'm out.
But it was too late. He'd been in Al-Qaeda. Mohamedou was captured a few years later. Here's an excerpt from his memoir, read by actor Stephen Fry.
The two guys grabbed me roughly, and since I couldn't walk on my own, they dragged me on the tips of my toes to the boat. Move! I can't move! They gave this order, knowing that I was too hurt to be able to move. After all, I was bleeding from my mouth, my ankles, my wrists, and maybe my nose. I couldn't tell for sure.
Nancy Hollander is Mohamedou's lawyer. She says Mohamedou was clearly tortured.
There's just no other way to describe what they did. While he was on the boat, he's blindfolded, and they would just hit him randomly. And there's nothing more terrorizing than not knowing, as he puts it, when the next smash is going to come, because you can't anticipate it.
This same method was used by the Nazis during World War II. U.S. interrogators also had something called the Frequent Flyer Program.
They would keep people awake, so he was interrogated sometimes 24 hours a day with rotating shifts and never allowed to sleep. And this went on for 70 days on 2 different occasions. It doesn't take long for lack of sleep to make you pretty crazy.
After beatings, they would stick ice cubes into Mohamedou's clothes.
Every once in a while, one of the guards smashed me, most of the time in the face. The ice served both for the pain and for wiping out the bruises I had from that afternoon. Everything seemed to be perfectly prepared. There is nothing more terrorizing than making somebody expect to smash every single heartbeat.
In 2010, a federal judge ordered Mohamedou's release from Guantanamo prison. But the U.S. government is fighting the order.
It sickens me that this country that has a good, solid criminal justice system just isn't using that system. And that the Obama administration, which we counted on to get us out of this horrible quagmire, has not done it. We now know how we got into all of this, but we don't seem to have a clue in this country how to get out of it. And so it just continues.
In his memoir, Mohamedou writes, "Has the American democracy passed the test it was subjected to after the 2001 terrorist attacks? What do the American people think? I would like to believe that the majority of Americans want to see justice done. But Mohamedou is still waiting for his justice from inside Guantanamo's prison walls." For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka. A sobering philosophical report. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're thinking about when democracies torture. We're joined now by Darius Rejali. He's a professor of political science at Reed College. He's a prolific author. He's got a fascinating book called Torture and Democracy. Darius, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Darius, you are from Iran. You're a young kid, but you're old enough to have lived under the Shah and then under the a regime after the revolution. The Shah was famous, among other things, for his torture. Is all of that Is that what sparked your interest in this as an academic topic?
Well, it certainly gave me an eye for dark humor and dark things, that's for sure. I grew up in a world where torture was routine and accepted and everybody knew it.
Wow. In a nutshell, after all your study, why shouldn't democracies in particular, use torture?
In a nutshell, I think it's an abuse of political power. I mean, we have a compact. Let me put it to you this way. In my view, human rights, if they mean anything, if they're not nonsense on stilts, are rights that we can hold against a particular kind of entity called the state. And when the state uses violence against us, it does so using the power that we have entrusted it to do. And it's, in my view, an abuse. Now, of course, the Romans held the other view, that it was totally fine. But there are democracies who've often argued that they should torture. I mean, the Roman Republic, for example.
So let me ask about democracy versus, because your book, Democracy and Torture, I mean, is it worse? So any human being you might think is entitled to dignity and basic rights, is it worse for a democracy to torture than it is for a tyranny to torture?
I think so, because a democracy claims at its heart that it's a community of recognition, that we're recognizing each other as having some kind of inherent dignity. And for that reason, one of the things that we define as characteristic of a democracy is that our punishments are humane. Humanity and punishment is a certain core notion that characterizes democratic life. Slaves might get tortured, even in ancient Greece, but the punishments that were appropriate for people of dignity have always been different.
So if I were a tyrant, could I get off the hook by saying, look, I never promised you any dignity, dude?
That's true. You know. And the Shah of Iran never promised anyone any dignity either. However, the Shah of Iran has a great interest in keeping a predictable and orderly government. And the question in his case is whether that's going to lead him to a stable government or to a revolution. We all know what the answer there was.
So you've kind of given us two answers. First answer is, you know, a legitimate state, there's a compact, a social contract. And that gives the government certain powers to use violence when it's needed for the reasons that were contracted. And torture just doesn't fit into that.
That's right.
But even if you're a tyrant and you didn't sign any contract, it's still pretty stupid to torture.
Yeah, stupid is a good word. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about torture and democracy with Darius Rejali from Reed College.
Is torture that different from other forms of coercion? When other lives depend on it, aren't we obliged to coerce the truth out of the rascal we've got in our custody?
Tyranny, democracy, and the temptation to torture when Philosophy Talk continues.
Do you really want to make me cry? Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want
Now, why would someone acting on behalf of a Democratic government want to make anybody cry, particularly if they had any culture, particularly if they're a club of cultured people? I don't know. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about what happens when democracies torture.
Our guest is Darius Rejali. He's from Reed College, right here in Portland, and he's the author of Torture and Democracy.
So, Darius, I want to think about, like, what makes torture a distinctive thing. It belongs, it seems to me, in the general categories of coercions, of coercive inducements. But I wonder if you can give us a taxonomy of coercions. I want you to help us understand the moral difference between, say, you know, offering somebody money, keeping them in jail, inducing mental suffering, and the kind of physical suffering that we call torture.
Well, I think the core of the definition of torture, it's certainly fuzzy around the edges, is this. It's got to have four things. One, it involves public authority or a designated public authority like a death squad. Second, it's got to have a detained and helpless individual. That person really is detained and helpless. The third, I would argue its core is physical injury, although we could talk about psychological. There's a space in that in the UN definition. And lastly, it should be done for public purpose. Information, intimidation, or confession. So here's the difference. When a policeman arrests you in part of his lawful function, he wrestles you to the ground or fires pepper spray and riot control, he's doing whatever the law requires him to do. The moment he arrests you and at that point attaches a taser to you, then he's in my zone.
Suppose you use the public part. Suppose a gang of miscreants grabs John. I was going to say me, but I'd rather they grab John.
Thanks, Ken.
And hold him down and tase him. They're not torturing him because they're not public officials?
That's interesting. The example I use is if someone tortures me in their basement. So is there a concept like private torture? My view is this. That it basically reflects two different views of human rights. My view is that it's absolutely critical from the standpoint of what our current legal mechanisms, that the person who tortures you be a public authority. Why? Because I think that when you or the gang of miscreants does that, they can be charged for assault, for manslaughter, for any number of things that are available to us in the law. But states are not responsible for manslaughter or anything like that. Human rights are those laws, those rights that we hold against states.
That's interesting.
So you're giving us a very focused definition of torture, but the focus has a purpose. It's not to let Hannibal Lecter off the hook because he's on a lot of hooks anyway.
Yes.
It's to really focus on what governments can do wrong, given that in some sense, unlike the rest of us, they have a right to violence.
That's right. And I want to keep the sharp end of the stick on government. So, for example, it's been a classic line of like all sorts of states, democratic or not. It's like, well, yeah, those ethnic groups, they kill each other. What can we do? You know, we can't actually get in the way. So I think that there are a number of conventions that basically say if you knew or should have known that these people were about to do that to John or Ken or whoever it is that they're going to do it to, and you didn't prevent it, doctrine of command responsibility, those people who did it are guilty of assault or murder, but you, state official, will be put on trial for torture.
That's very sharp. That's very illuminating. I want to ask you about another element of that, though, because you said something about helplessness, and I've read a lot of stuff where torture is meted upon the helpless victim. Suppose that you and I, we're both state actors. You're a state actor, and I'm a different state actor, and we're fighting to the death. Right. And I've got more power than you, and I'm pummeling the heck out of you. But I don't have you tied down. I'm just pummeling the heck out
of
you.
And to the extent
am I not torturing you?
No. Well, to the extent that we're in, that's a condition of war. I mean, presumably, when soldiers who are designated officials meet on the field of battle with whatever vehicles, machines they have, they're facing each other's equals. It's the disparity between someone who is capable of freedom and someone who lacks all freedom. And here I would actually go down to the point of it's like the core of this, I mean, if you want to think about it, is the crucifixion. If you want to think about it, Jesus dies on the cross. The whole heart of the problem of the crucifixion, there are three objections. It creates a space for vengeance, which it adds humiliation to justice, and it adds extra pain beyond what justice demanded.
So, you know, this is perhaps something that neither Ken or I or most of our listeners are going to take put up too much of a fight to be persuaded there's something wrong with torture. But one thing that's often remarked is that torture, in addition to these problems, is ineffective. And John McCain, I think with considerable justice, says, let's not focus on that. Let's focus on the intrinsic wrongness of torture. But let's do focus on this at least for a second. Mm-hmm. Is it ineffective or is it effective?
Well, I think that there are a number of small cases in which torture has been effective. But I will tell you what their characteristics all are. They happen in domestic, often non-emergency peacetime situations, exactly when you don't need them. And there's a lot of really good reasons why they work under those conditions. In the fog of war, the error rate for torture is enormous. And at that point, if torture works, in the best case scenarios, we're talking about arresting minimally between 8,000 to 10,000 people. And in that context, you're going to get 20 to 78 mistakes for every one accurate hit. So the question is, what's an acceptable error rate?
Can you point to any disasters where democracy is tortured and been led astray?
Oh, let's see. I'll take one. His name was Yusuf Sheikh Halabi. He was arrested in Afghanistan. He was tortured somewhere, and he identified that under torture, he confessed to seeing Saddam, to making a link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein trying to create weapons of mass destruction. This was the evidence that went into Colin Powell's speech, which then told us that there was a connection between terrorism and led us to war in Iraq and to the war that we now know. It was based on false information.
I think I read this in your work, and I think I picked it up somewhere else too, but I distinctly recall you discussing the Gestapo and their torture techniques. And the Gestapo actually, you think of tyrants as the paradigm torturers. The Gestapo actually, at least early on, wasn't really all that into torture, right? They didn't think it was all that an effective means.
There were definitely professional Gestapo interrogators. And I think it's important to recognize that insofar as we're talking about torture for intimidation, the Gestapo never hesitated, right? But in terms of torture for information, which is often what we're talking about in democracies, that's a real problem. The classic example here is Reichsprotector Himmler. When he was assassinated, the guys in jackboots went out and they managed to kill and arrest 7,545 people, liquidate two villages. They managed to get 100 members of the resistance, but they still didn't manage to get the guys until the professional interrogator came, put out an award of some money, and Korda, who was a member of the resistance, walked into Gestapo headquarters and gave the whole operation away.
No torture there.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're coming to you from Oregon Public Broadcasting, and we've got Tina from Ontario on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Tina.
Hey, y'all are having a pretty good discussion about this. It's a pretty touchy subject these days. How y'all doing?
Okay, how are you doing, Tina? What's your comment or question, though? What's your comment
or question? Well, basically, I was in the Army Reserve for 6 years, and all of my family members have been in the military. And there's a perfectly good reason somebody has to be tortured sometimes. But I just would like for you to take one perspective, and this is what's important. If your family member was taken hostage, and you had a terrorist or an individual sitting in front of you who you knew where your family member was, would you authorize torture, period? If you can answer that question with no, I wouldn't have them tortured, knowing that your family member is going to be beheaded, then I think that brings it home for people, and that's the way most people see it. And if you had a whole family in the military, you would understand war is hell, and some people have to pay hell because they are from hell doing hellish things to nice people, okay? And so America has to do a dirty job sometimes.
Okay.
So you look at it, just one thing. Look at it as if your mother, your daughter, or your father was hidden somewhere, and that person in front of you knew where they were. That's all I'm going to say.
Tina, I'm going to put that to Darius and see what you're going to make of it. What do you make of Tina's hypothetical, Darius?
I guess I would put it this way. If you think you have an argument of that sort and you are in a position to do that, fine. And then I would say stand before a jury of your peers. That's my response. And make that argument and face the consequences of making that decision. And if you're right, no one will ever convict you. But here's the bottom line. There isn't a single torturer I have ever met, read about or interviewed who has ever had the courage to do that.
So let me, but I want to go back to something that Tina suggests. I think, because we talked about the compact in the beginning, right, between the government and its citizens. I think it's one thing to use torture as an instrument of the state's police power, for it to torture confessions out of, out of criminal suspects, for it to use torturous forms of punishment of convicted criminals. I think that's really bad. It's not clear to me that torture as an instrument of war has the same badness as torture as an instrument of the state's police power. I mean, help me think about that.
So I think there are principled arguments for the argument that Tina gave is the classic consequentialist argument. But there are arguments that are principled arguments. The argument that the Algerian general Tronchier gave was something like this. When terrorists hide in populations, they disguise themselves and they don't face the soldiers as uniformed soldiers facing other uniformed soldiers on a field of war. When we capture them, we give them the opportunity to show their dignity as soldiers face-to-face in a game of pain, so to speak. Now,
It's
a manly way of putting it. Yeah. But I find that argument a lot more persuasive. But I think here's the problem with that argument. Once we get into the business of considering other people as not human, we enter into a very dangerous space. We've already come out of a country which already had made decisions about how whole portions of its population weren't human and therefore were capable of slavery or capable of torture. And once we enter into that zone, we're in a very dangerous space indeed.
But I want to go back to Tina's challenge because, frankly, when I put myself in the position she suggests, maybe my daughter or son or grandson or granddaughter, I know has been taken and hidden by this fellow who I've somehow got in my grip.
Right.
And he won't tell me where they are. Would I inflict pain in the hope, in the chance that he would tell me? Yes, I would. Would I do it under the circumstances you say and not worry about whether it's legal, go before the court and said, yes, I tortured him, and here's what's happened. I think I would. I hope I would.
Well, it depends.
I find it a little hard. You've never found a single case of that.
I haven't found a single case of that, actually, of a ticking time bomb. Never has been a case like that. That story comes out of a novel that was written in the middle of the Algerian War. But, I mean, and there are a number of things about that example that I find troublesome. So which torture technique do you plan to use, and what is its effectiveness rate? For example, are you going to use sleep deprivation to get the information to save your family? Sleep deprivation is a fantastic technique if you want to have hallucinations. And so which hunters used it to get confessions, because it's perfect for seeing Al-Qaeda or, you know, Osama bin Laden shooting Kennedy from behind the grassy knoll. But, I mean, the bottom line is that if we have to go technique by technique, I can tell you what the error rates of these things are.
Okay.
They're horrible. The point is that you're going to have to go through a volume business, and by that point, your family person will be dead. And let me give you the alternative. The alternative is public cooperation and identification of the enemy through human capital, and that, let me tell you, is really fast.
Well, what I would do is bend their fingers back. I mean, I haven't used that a long time since I was a teenager, but it worked pretty well when somebody had hidden my watch or something like that.
So you really think you're going to get information I really think
Tina has a point that in a certain circumstance, you would torture, and you have a point that, well, if it's justified, it doesn't need to be made legal. The jury will let you off. I'm just a little surprised you've never found a real instance of that.
There's a email from David. He's got a couple of emails, but there's one that's in direct disagreement with Tina because he's a veteran too. He says, I'm a veteran with a military family, and I have to strongly disagree with Tina's point. If our value as a society is that torture is wrong, then it's always wrong, or our values mean nothing. So he's a military man standing up for consistency. So it's not quite right that all the military people...
No, actually, the polls, can I be specific? Yeah. The polls of the military on the ticking time bomb situation are this. MHAT did 3 polls on the U.S. military during the height of the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
It looked at regular reserves and it looked at Marines. And overwhelmingly, the majority of Marines and the majority of reserve soldiers and regular enlisted soldiers opposed torture, even if it meant saving the life of a buddy in the field. I think the number for regular enlisted soldiers was 35%, and the number for Marines was 42%.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, and Jerry in Portland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jerry. What's your comment or question?
Thank you. Yeah, it's interesting to listen to Tina's and your response to that. However, my question was about the death penalty in the United States. States and the United States government have a death penalty, and there's been a whole lot of cases whereby people have been sentenced to death probably under adverse circumstances, and they have not admitted to anything and has died, and yet they found out that maybe they were innocent. So it seems to me like it torture really doesn't get you anywhere.
Well, thanks for the call, Jerry. Now, I'm going to put a thought to you. I don't think the death penalty may be wrong. And I think it is wrong, but I don't think it's wrong because it's torture, except perhaps the way we do it in the United States, where you're on death row forever and you get to live with this anticipation. But if I'm going to kill you painlessly, you know, why is that torture?
Yeah, okay. So on that point, I think I would make a slightly different argument. I don't think it's torture, although I think you can argue that, like torture, what should the error rate be and what's an acceptable error rate for democracy? And I would argue that for the death penalty in particular, the error rate has to be zero. Because you can't undo mistakes. So when Governor Ryan, so there's a story here that's worth telling, if you don't mind just me going. There was a policeman by the name of Commander Burge. He came back from Vietnam. He was an MP. He had tortured Viet Cong to get information. He brought those torture techniques back to Chicago in 72. And from between 72 and 92, probably at least 120 people, I think, were tortured to confess to capital crimes and went – the system got corrupted. So this is one of the ways in which torture always comes home. When you're an MP out there and you come back and become a policeman, it comes back to your neighborhood. We're not talking about out there in here. And Governor Ryan had to suspend the death penalty because nobody knew how many of these confessions were coerced. So – torture corrupts the very judicial system that you want to protect.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about democracies, when democracies torture. Our guest is Darius Rajali from Reed College.
How do democracies justify torture, or at least enhanced interrogation techniques, when they're forced to?
Torturing suspects for tortured reasons, when Philosophy Talk continues.
We may have done away with a whipping post, but nowadays democracies engage in more subtle forms of torture. But what should we make of that? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Darius Rajali, and he's author of Torture and Democracy.
Darius, people have different views about torture, as has been shown on this program, but by and large, probably Ken and I and most of our listeners are pretty skeptical that torture is ever or at least not very often justified. And you certainly seem to be. So I want to ask you, as an academic, a person who's studied this, who's read a lot and written a lot, what's the best, the most persuasive defense for the limited use of torture by a liberal democracy like ours, and what's your response to it?
Well, I believe I gave it, which is that so some people think that torture, as you said, Alan Dershowitz thinks that it should be legalized, but it's terrible, it's immoral. I think that position is mistaken because it corrupts your legal system completely. But I do hold with Mark Bowden. I think Mark Bowden's argument is actually the better argument, which is, you know, if there could be a circumstance, he holds that it's you should never legalize torture because it will corrupt your legal system, and it will create it makes for lazy soldiers and lazy interrogators who whack the mistaken truth out of people. But that there could be the extreme circumstance which could be justifiable, and he says that that person should then stand trial and answer for it, which I totally buy. Right, I accept that because it it has at its heart a notion of democratic responsibility.
So is this a little bit like the distinction between rule utilitarianism and act utilitarianism? The rules have to be something that people can recognize and that usually gets the right result. But in an individual case, an exception to the rule may be the best thing to be done, but it would be worse to incorporate it into the rule than just not.
It might be a distinction like that, but it's also embedded within a juridical understanding of how our relationships. So there's also a notion that the concept of rights also is incorporated within
this. So we have a question from a caller that I think is a very good question from Danny in Portland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Danny. What's your comment or question?
Hi, thank you. So most thinking people tend to agree, based on what I've been hearing today, that torture is bad, and especially in the context of a democracy. So I wonder what we as citizens in this democracy, what is our duty as citizens to do to either prevent or stop, or what do we do about it as citizens?
Very good question, Danny. So, Darius, you got any answers for us?
Sure. I mean, I think, first of all, I think it depends on who you are and what kind of citizen you are. For example, President Obama has something called the High-Value Detainee Interrogation Group, and their job is to actually find scientific and evidence-based ways to interrogate people through rapport building to get accurate information. These are people who were involved in interrogating the Tsarnaev brothers, and the Boston Marathon case. So there are a number of things government officials can do. Citizens, in my view, and this is the core of my argument in Torture and Democracy, is that the reason that democracies use clean techniques that nobody can see is because your church group and your press is watching them, right? Because if everybody was for torture, if everybody really was for torture, like every authoritarian state, we'd have like tortured people all over the streets and everybody would know it. But the problem is we don't want other people to know. This is what in my world we'd call targeted deterrence as opposed to general deterrence. The minorities who are tortured know that they're going to be tortured, but the general population is completely oblivious.
See, you know what though? There's a kind of optimism beneath that kind of recommendation. And one of the things I get as I get older and older is less optimistic about citizens of a democracy. Because think of all this police brutality that's coming to light. And there are – and all this video all over the place. You say the cold light of publicity will make this go
away.
No. But you know what happens?
I didn't say that.
You know what happens in the cold light of publicity? People say, see what the police have to do.
I think in the cold light of publicity, what happens is when we're watching the cops get sneaky, I'm actually – a lot darker than you are on that. It's like when everybody knows that you're watching, they'll twist fingers. They won't bend people's arms back, but they'll throw them down some stairs and call it an accident, right? I mean, I actually think democracy is a poor check on torture, and all the social scientific evidence is beginning to pile up against that argument. There are a number of reasons why that's the case. Public opinion is a very weak check on it. For example, most people forget that during the whole time of the Bush administration, torture policy, opposition to torture in America was consistently at about 60%.
You know why that is, I think? Because democracy is about we the people. That's true. But we the people, there is the other out there. Yeah. Either that part of our citizenry that we don't want to own as equal to us, or the enemy that we don't want to own. So democracy is just like any – I mean, we're still human beings.
Well,
we still divide ourselves.
Yeah, I actually think there's something else going on here, which is the bystander effect, which is that whenever you see someone in danger, you look to other people to see if there's a problem. And if everybody else is acting like there's no problem, everybody walks past a dying man on the sidewalk, right? This is called pluralistic ignorance. And what we find in our research is that this is kind of what happens. If everybody thinks that everybody else is for torture and doesn't realize that the majority really is against torture, then everybody just walks by it, right? But I think leaving aside – I mean, the problem of pluralistic – there are I think the key, the core of this is, if we're going to talk about this, is training that's targeted towards interrogators and police officers. In Europe, for example, they use a technique called the peace method, which is a pretty clear interrogation method. And if you all remember that guy in Norway who killed all those young people, he claimed that there were two other tactical squad teams about to go out and kill people. I actually know the policeman who actually interrogated that guy within, you know, 5 or 6 hours after they arrested him. I've seen the video of it. It's amazing. And the peace method actually reduces the level of false confessions and gets you accurate information. Well, so our cops don't want to do it. And I've asked, why don't we do it? And they say, oh, you don't understand. Our criminals, they're tougher than the criminals in Europe.
I want to ask you, okay, I want to say something that sounds perverse, though. I know it does, but I just want your response to it. Somebody, you mentioned this in passing about the Gestapo. They weren't so much into torture as a way of extracting information, but humiliation and degradation, they were. I mean, So torture as a way of dehumanizing the person you want to dehumanize is a pretty effective thing.
Yeah, no one objects. I mean, it's kind of interesting, but torture's intimidation is obviously works. I mean, death squads work. Let's face it. I mean, but no one's arguing for that. Torture to produce confessions, false confessions, is kind of interesting. The statistics from Ancien Régime France, where we had a routinized legal confession in which they broke your shins and put in boiling water and did a certain kind of what we would call waterboarding. You know what percentage of people confessed under those circumstances? At most, depending on the county, 13%.
Oh, really?
It's kind of amazing. They couldn't even get words out of these people back. And this is like 300 years ago.
We got a caller who wants to weigh in on just this point. It's with a great name, I must add. Kenneth in Portland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Kenneth.
Hello there.
What's your comment or question?
I remember an interview that Jesse Ventura gave where he said, I'm ex-military and torture's no good, and I'll tell you why. You give me torture, and in 5 minutes I can have you confessing to JFK's murder, even if you weren't even born at the time. Because someone being tortured will tell you anything you want to hear, but there's no guarantee any of it's the truth. And if you can't know that, none of it's any good.
Yeah, thanks.
The whole reason for torture is got to make the torturer feel good, period.
I think this is a critical point that Jesse makes, and thank you, Kenneth, as well. I mean, look, in the fog of war, when you're dealing with a counterinsurgency situation, you don't know whether you have the guy who put your family in that position or not. You're arresting in volume, right? So the problem is that the person who actually is the guilty person he is not going to lie any more or less than the person, whether he's tortured or not. But an innocent person who has absolutely no information, and you're going to have them in spades in that context, is going to give you a lot of wasted information, and you're going to lose a lot of time. So I think the issue is not so much a lot of people say this. People will say anything. The nonsense that a guilty person says is no less or more than – but the nonsense that innocent people say is hugely misleading and an incredible waste of time.
Did the ancient regime keep track of the 13% who talked? What percent gave useful information?
No, because they were actually interested in confessions, and so the confession – that allowed them to burn them or whatever appropriate thing. The accuracy, it's really hard to get real numbers on accuracy. But, I mean, the few cases that I actually have identified are – I mean, basically you got a problem. You go out in a wartime situation. You can't tell the enemy from civilians. You're going to arrest them in large numbers. So your first problem is to get the people who don't know anything out of your system so you can focus on the people who know something.
So look, suppose the world reads your book and learns all the lessons you have to teach them. So would torture just go away? Because it sounds like it's got no real point except for the intimidation kind of point. Would torture as an instrument of coercion and getting confession, do you think it would just go away if people were just rational and learned the lessons
you want them? This is the thing that I think we've talked about arguments for torture that are rational. But in my business, I meet a lot of arguments for torture that are not rational. And in that sense, so for example, all our polling data shows that torture right now, torture has increased among Republicans from about 40% to about 85% of Republicans are now for torture. It's a huge...
In any circumstance whatsoever?
More or less, depending on the poll that you're looking at, right? So it's now become a partisan divide. So just like the death penalty, people just think to be tough on torture is to be tough on terrorism. To be tough on terrorism is to use torture. To be tough on crime is to be for it. They don't even care about its effectiveness. They don't care about its consequences. It's strictly retributivist,
so,
right?
Darius, that's a really sober, depressing note. And it's not really one I want to end on, but it's one we have to end on because, gosh, but we have to have you back with it. Talk some more so we can end on a high note.
I got a lot of upbeat things to say. It's just that the questions were dark. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Darius. Our guest has been Darius Rejali. He's a professor of political science at Reed College. He's author. You've got to pick up this book. It's a great book. It's a great read. It's very, very fascinating. Torture and Democracy. So, John, now your thoughts, torturous today or what?
Well, I think I'm going to get into this field because Darius seems like such a jolly, upbeat guy. I mean, I'm gonna take my research project on sex and joy and put it over to the side and get into torture, you know.
So, well, you know, the thing that gets me is I think it's really true that, I mean, that there's this irrational stuff driving a lot of our public policies. As philosophers, I like to think reason can dominate and we can argue rationally about these things, but I'm not so sure I should believe that. What do you think that reason discussion can end practices like torture?
Well, I don't know. Philosophy has started a lot of things and ended a few things, but it takes hundreds of years. I hope maybe we can have Darius on at some future time and talk about this idea that of psychological torture, and he doesn't want to call it torture, but I wonder what he thinks about it and what other name he has for it. But that'll have to wait for another time.
Yeah, no, psychological torture is a really interesting phenomenon. I don't know why I would want to include it. I mean, mental anguish is as serious an anguish as any anguish. But, you know, there's lots and lots to think about here. And this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, get this, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you too, and we'd love to have you do this, you too can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's have a word from the tortured mind of Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, back in 1965, there was a coup in Indonesia. The CIA, it is said, was very helpful in handing over names of potential communists to Suharto and his gangs. Some in the West believed this coup would make the Vietnam War unnecessary because it pretty much destroyed communism in Indonesia. But apparently the American war machine, man, was not paying attention. We had to wait another generation before the Cold War ended, and now, of course, we have the War on Terror. And the 30 Years War version 2.0, instead of Christian versus Christian, it's Muslim versus Muslim. Let the good times roll. Well, they never stop, I guess. Back in 1965, 500,000 Indonesians were killed, supposed communists, intellectuals, farmers, and ethnic Chinese, 1 million more tortured, displaced, exiled. Today, Indonesia is a democracy, sort of, but there never has been a reckoning. The period is not glossed over exactly. It was like that Thanksgiving when Uncle Ned made an idiot of himself, only with mass graves. Let's not go there, okay? Filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer did go there and returned from Indonesia with a bizarre documentary, Act of Killing. He worked on it with an Indonesian co-director who chose to be anonymous. The directors got an elderly former thug named Anwar Kongo to gleefully reenact his own atrocities. He specialized in garroting his victims and even gives a demonstration of how that works. He started out in a gang that scalped black market movie tickets, and he was a huge movie fan. A paramilitary youth group Kongo helped found is still active and was seen in the documentary, extorting protection money from shopkeepers. So the documentary is a weird mix of talking heads with nods to westerns, musicals, comedies, and gangster movies. At one point, Kongo dyes his hair black and acts as one of his own victims. And then he has some kind of epiphany. He tells the director he thinks he finally understands what his victims felt like. The director gently points out, no, he doesn't, because his victims are all dead. The end shows Mr. Kongo dry-heaving on a rooftop, the location of many of his executions. Many said this showed him finally coming to terms with what he'd done. Well, I don't know. Could be he was just movie acting. The director said his idea for this movie was to explore the concept of impunity. There's certainly no punishment for Anwar Kongo, unless you consider the documentary itself a punishment. Various websites have left comments on the movie and the Indonesian legacy of death and torture. Says one, as long as they're eliminating communists, I could care less. Then there was, what do you expect from the country with the most Muslims? The inevitable, Obama was educated in Indonesia, so this makes complete sense. And ultimately, blood be on Hollywood. See the nuance? If it hadn't been for action movies, none of this would have happened. And that's what we do with torture in a modern democracy. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Thanks also to Ted Muldoon, Merle Kessler, Erica Topit, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Cardinal Biggers, poke him with the soft cushions!